like I literally scored, started running towards Jamie, and then I just looked to the right. I just seen my mum was just up there waving her hands like screaming, so I just stopped and just started screaming at her. It was funny.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast, stream wherever you get your podcasts, and download the OTB Sports app.
And you're welcome to the Sunday Paper Review and Off the Ball. John Duggan here sitting in for Joe Molloy. I'm delighted to be joined by the former Leinster and Ireland rugby player Bernard Jackman and the sports editor of the Irish Daily Mail, Orla McElroy, to review the stories of this Sunday. Orla, you're in this fantastic studio.
Yeah, first time in here. It's great. Great to finally be on this side of the, looking in around the studio rather than looking at it.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you here in studio with us. And also, Bernard, you're on Zoom. How are we getting on?
I never got the invite, guys, but don't worry. I won't hold it against you.
I know, Bernard. It's great to see you. And it's actually a landmark here, because I'm just picking up the Sunday Independent. You're not allowed to talk about your own article. So I've got Ireland find new Top Gear as speed and skill route Japan. Bernard, we're not allowed to talk about this, okay? So we can talk around it. But great to see you in the papers on the Sunday Paper Review. But what we'll do is we'll talk about that game and many more things, including Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, over the next hour. Let's go through the front pages of the broadsheets and the back pages as well. This is the Sunday Independent Sport. So Centurion Sexton leads Wei and Roush. Japan put to the sword on a special day for Irish captain. 100 caps for Johnny Sexton. Brilliant reception when he got that try in the second half at the Aviva Stadium in our 60-5 win over Japan. So that is in the Sunday Independent. We have the Sunday Times. Wrong choice, Cristiano. Picking United over City does not look too clever as league champions outclass neighbours on Derby Day. And two former captains lay into United. That is the front page of the Sunday Times. We've got the back of Orla's paper, the Irish Daily Mail on Sunday. So in the groove, Ireland's attacking brilliance destroys Japan as Farrell's men send that message to All Blacks. And looking ahead, Kenny plans for long term as he hatches plot for Ronaldo. That is the Irish Mail on Sunday. Back of the Sunday World, we have Rodgers and Oush. So Ollie for the sack as Brendan Rodgers is shock contender to be the new United boss. Let's wait and see. That's in the Sunday World. And Johnny's a legend. Emotional Sexton stars in his 100th Ireland cap, pictured with that samurai sword he was presented with by the Japanese squad. And City simply toyed with United, says Paul McGrath in the Sunday World. We've got the Sunday Mirror Sport, men versus boys. United boss Solskjaer on the brink after Derby humiliation. Sexton is so special. And Southgate hits back at Klopp over criticism by the German of some of his selections and team issues. Quit now, Ollie. Keane, he'd be better off resigning. This is Roy Keane on Sky Sports. Roy Keane has told under fire Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to quit Manchester United now for his own sake. And we also have Sexton and the City win and Edding into the tune. This is Eddie Howe set to take over as Newcastle boss. And then Farke Joy then axed Norwich's first win of the season in the Premier League, and then Daniel Farke got shown the door, bottom of the table. That is the Sun on Sunday. We've also got other papers, The Observer, Theatre of Screams, David De Gea preventing humiliation, but City outclass United to turn the heat back on Solskjaer. That is The Observer. And just a profile as well, we will touch upon on Henry Shefflin. This is in the Sunday Business Post. A star called Henry on Henry Shefflin's now ascension to the throne in Galway. The former Kilkenny star and legend and 10-time All-Ireland winner going to take over the hot seat in Galway. And that's a Barry White article we'll touch upon in the next hour. Orla, you were at the Aviva Stadium for that Johnny Sexton reception yesterday. It's probably one of the easiest articles for any newspaper editor to be getting in their teeth into and writing about. It's such a feel-good story.
Yeah, it was great. He got a huge reception, and he was delighted with the reception he got from the crowd. I heard him talking afterwards, and he was very emotional. It's not something you usually see from Johnny Sexton. He got very emotional talking about how it felt, and he mentioned David Kelly mentions it, I think, in his piece in his quotes in the Sunday Indo, where Sexton said he felt a bit guilty because there are guys like Keane Healy who won his 100th cap, and then two of my best friends in the game, Fergus McFadden and Rob Kearney, and they retired in an empty stadium. So it was lovely to see him get that send off in a
It was apt, wasn't it? It was an apt send-off for his 100th cap, and hopefully many more from him, because Ronan O'Gara didn't get that opportunity, I was reading during the week.
No, and it's not often that they do. Brian O'Driscoll famously did, you know, it all went to plan for him, but they don't always get that. You know, Paul O'Connell's another one who didn't get the send-off he deserved. So it was great, you know, and he got to score a try and celebrate that, and then he's taken off and he gets to, you know, receive the applause from the crowd and got a standing ovation going off. There was, you know, there was great admiration and appreciation for everything he's done for Ireland over the years from everybody that was there.
Yeah, quotes from Dennis Walsh in the Sunday Times. Captain shows why he's still Ireland's best number 10. Sexton has never come across as sentimental either, but yesterday was charged with such emotion that he simply couldn't glide above it. He said that his try in the corner and the response of the crowd had been one of the greatest moments of his career, and you can imagine why. And Sexton is still the best available by such a distance that he will fill the jersey for as long as his body is able and his mind is willing. For as long as that lasts, it'll be our pleasure. Bernard, he's come a long way, Johnny Sexton. You would have known him when he was a young lad at Leinster and one of our greatest ever players.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think the public are getting to see the real Johnny Sexton. And, you know, there are certain times when people were critical of him in terms of, you know, a look he gave a teammate, or maybe how he spoke in the press or looked a sulk. But what you get with Johnny Sexton is what you see. And the emotional side that we saw yesterday, you know, he's like that when he feels like that, you know, in the dressing room, where there's a lot of players or coaches who you know, cover up their raw emotions. And he's just a very, very good family man, very proud to play for Leinster, very proud to play for Ireland. And he saw, I think, how much his team respect and enjoy him, you know, how they celebrated when he scored. And, you know, he's a real authentic leader. And he's been a leader since he was 19 or 20. And he's much loved by anyone who's ever played with him, much attested by players who play against him. But I think that's what you want in an elite sports performer, because teams know that if Johnny's on form, he has a big influence on the game. So lovely moment for him yesterday, well deserved. And again, it's typical of him that he's thinking back to Rob Kearney and Fergus McFadden, etc. And I know I spoke to him, and as Leinster captain, he was very conscious of what they could do to I suppose recognise Fergus and Rob's influence and careers in Leinster in COVID, and obviously the restrictions around it. And he was actively out there looking to try and find ways they could make it special, even though obviously they weren't getting the day out in front of the fans. And that's the kind of, he's a giver. He's someone, I think, that I haven't played with him. If you had a problem and you went to Johnny, he'd do everything in his power to.
Yeah.
So, and he's still playing brilliant rugby. He's so key to Ireland Leinster.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had the performance as well from the Ireland team. This is on Jameson Gibson Park from Brendan Fanning in the Sunday Independent. His connection with Andrew Conway was a touch of Torvald and Dean. The best bit was that both players had drawn a fair amount of unwanted attention when the team was announced. Conway, at the precise moment he needed it, looked like a kid who was the talk of the town when playing fullback for Blackrock College. The measure of his excellence and Gibson Park's part in it was the morale-busting aerial job he did on Matsushima. You were very impressed with the performance, Bernard.
Yeah, it was an excellent performance, and I thought Brendan's piece was very good. I like Rory Keane's piece in the Irish Mail on Sunday, because he starts off with, you know, Paul O'Connell earlier this week talking about the new breed of Irish rugby player, and I think that's absolutely key. I thought selection-wise, Farrell was able to get the right people on the pitch to play the type of game they've been talking about for 2 years. And, you know, there was some of the selections, James Lowe, Andrew Conway, Gibson Park were questioned during the week by pundits, and myself included, but they were actually really, really impressive. And the game plan was played to suit their strengths. So James Lowe wasn't just stuck on the left wing. He was coming into the line at fullback. You know, most of our aerial contestable kicks were down Andrew Conway's side, which he's brilliant at, and he won the back. And then Gibson Park was on the front foot. And a couple of things, I mean, last season, Caelan Doris had a concussion issue, so he wasn't playing every week. We've now changed Andrew Porter from tight head to loose head, so while he's usually coming on for the last 20 minutes, now we have an all-action front row of Porter, Kelleher and Tyke Furlong, who get you over the gain line. Conan and Doris, as I said, and Van der Fleer are footballers, so they're comfortable in his wider channels. And then you've Gibson Park, who, he was getting the ball on a plate because our carry and our breakdown work was really good, but he's a constant threat. And everything didn't go through Johnny. And I remember last year listening to George Ford speak about how England scout opposition teams. And he basically said, look, we don't have to watch many clips when we play Ireland. We just basically say, look, wherever Johnny is, the ball will be. And that wasn't the case yesterday at all. There was lots of different first receivers. Gary Ringer was popping up, as James Lowe was popping up, etc. So that's a big transition for us as this team grows, and it gives us more chance of winning things, because the way the game we were playing was too slow and stagnant, and we didn't have the power to be able to win at that level like South Africa do. But now you can see. You can see some real smarts tactically. The boys seem to be enjoying it. I think we get great confidence from that. And it wasn't just, like, we were very good against England in the last game of Six Nations. We were good against Japan and USA without our lines. But I thought that's the fourth game in a row where you can see development, and it leads into the All Blacks nicely.
Anything else in the papers about the game itself that you picked up upon, Orla?
Well, I think Bernard said it very well in his own piece, which I know you guys won't refer to, but he did say it was... the Irish team played at a pace that I've never seen from us before, and it's true, it was so full on, and it was very quick, and it was really enjoyable rugby to watch, which is great, because that's not what we've seen. And you know, it was really enjoyable to just see them throwing it around, and the interplay between forwards and backs. I think Bernard touched on it, and I'd been thinking as well that Jamison Gibson-Park was, you know, you were looking at him going, why does Farrell keep sticking with him? But you can see with that faster game why he does that and why he plays it, because he was excellent and the team plays so much faster, and it was wonderful. Rory O'Connor in his piece mentioned one great stat that having averaged 5 offloads a game in Farrell's first 16 games, they threw 14 in a scintillating first half and finished with 18.
Yeah, I picked that one up as well, that offload stat. And we might have a bit of quiet confidence now with the All Blacks coming to Dublin next Saturday, Bernard. I was reading Brendan Fanning talking about it's impossible to avoid the blowback from punters over the baseline €125 to park your rear end in the seat at the Aviva Stadium on Saturday. If you're forking out for two, that's a hole in your budget. As for families, does anybody on a modest income really see an event like this as a day out for parents and a few kids? Look, the IRFU are cash strapped. COVID has been very difficult for everybody. But also really the tenor of the piece as well, that the All Blacks, for them, it's a long slog and they're on a spring tour, as it were, but maybe yesterday will give us all the hope for that game.
Absolutely. I think I'm a lot more hopeful than I was. This is the time to beat the All Blacks when they're at the end of their season. The All Blacks are a phenomenally good team, but they're not set up around defence first. You know, they're not as good a defensive side as England or the Springboks. So the fact that we are looking to change how we play, it looks like we have the tools to play that game. We will create opportunities, and the offloading stats, is very relevant. But it's because we're actually running at space. There's good decoy lines. We're playing off quick ball, and that's why the players were comfortable to be able to throw those passes in and out of contact. And that's the reality of it. Like, if you're getting shut down, if you're getting caught behind the gain line, yeah, you know, your offloads are going to be down. So I think, in fairness to Mike Catt, when he came in after the World Cup, he spoke about creating this game, and it has taken a while. And look at it, it's probably not where it needs to be or it's going to be. But I certainly think the All Blacks coming to town next week, it's going to be a phenomenal occasion. I agree the tickets are ridiculously expensive, but I do think it's going to be a phenomenal occasion. I think we have a team that can really challenge them.
That's an easy story to get excited about, the Irish rugby team and their great performance yesterday. I was expecting a close match, 60-5. It was a blowout, really, with Andrew Conway as well getting 3 tries in the game. But not an easy story to read about in the Sunday Times. Or David Walsh with an interview with the former rugby player Tim Cowley after his career and his uncertainty over concussions he's had in his career and what future he'll have in life.
Yeah, it's very hard to read these stories. There's the case that's going on at the moment, I think it was Steve Thompson and Alex Popham who took it over their diagnoses of early onset dementia and other neuro problems that they've suffered. And this is another one. It's an interview with Tim Cowley, who David Walsh introduces it by talking about his life in France now and where he lives. And he gives tours of vineyards, and it sounds like an idyllic life. But then he talks about the issues that he's suffered since he retired in 2011 at the age of 33, and he's, you know, he's struggled with depression and anxiety, anger issues. A lot of the, you hear a lot of these similar problems come up time and time
again. Recurring, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same theme. And we had during the week, Carl Heyman, the All Black former prop, who's only 41, talking about having been diagnosed with early onset dementia as well. So there's a big issue there. There's a big issue for rugby. Through the piece, Cowley talks about how he felt it was a measure of himself as a rugby player to be seen to be leading from the front, and, you know, with big tackles, and if you get knocked down, you get back up again and you hit harder the next time and you come out running. And it's just, it's scary stuff. You know, he talks about, we thought it was normal. Concussions were when you got knocked out. The normal bangs just made you a bit dazed and blurry, and after a few seconds you'd be able to get on with it. We had no idea there might be long-term consequences. And of course we know now that there are, and some of the consequences that people are dealing with are very troubling and, you know, scary for parents, for people who are playing the game now. You do hope that rugby gets a handle on this and deals with it, so that there aren't so many more stories like this coming out.
Yeah, not an easy read, Bernard, and as a former player yourself and a member of the front row, how are you feeling about all these stories coming out? Are you worried, or are you reflecting upon your own career?
I try not to think about it too much, to be honest. I am very lucky. I suffered a lot of concussions at the end of my career, and certainly I felt that there was a slowness in the dressing room to miss a game because of concussion. And I remember there used to be a whiteboard in Leinster with everybody's injuries and time to return to play, and you never really saw concussion on that. And so when I retired in 2010, I started to do some work for Cry Brain Injury Ireland. And in fairness, the game has moved on massively in terms of players being aware and not being afraid to admit to concussion or to miss a period of time. And Kenan Doris took a long break last year, and he's back playing for Ireland now, under obviously strict medical supervision and with the okay to play. So I think the game has moved on a long way. And obviously the World Rugby have introduced strict controls around how much contact time in a match week as well, to try and, I suppose, protect players. But having said that, I think that if you look at the statistics now, there's a lot more collision points in the game than there was, you know, 10 years ago. So, you know, a James Ryan or a Tadhg Byrne played second row for Ireland yesterday, you know, will have a lot more physical contacts over a course of 80 minutes than, you know, a Malcolm O'Kelly or Dunic O'Callaghan did, you know, 10 years ago. So that's just reality of it, but it's a big worry. It's a big issue for World Rugby. There, that's why there's such focus on this head-high contact sanctions during games, red cards, etc., to try and make the game safer. I think medically it's moved on a long way, but also, you know, there's only so much you can protect the brain. Tackle technique is important, and has been focused on, you know, massively. Clean out technique is being focused on, but it is worrying. And there's a rugby league group now as well, led by Bobby Goulding, who are suffering from dementia as well, and they're looking to make their case known and speaking to the governing body. So look, unfortunately it's far too common. You know, every week now there's a player of my vintage, and you're hearing that they're really I think there's huge empathy within the game for these players. When you see this article and read it from Dave Walsh, and you see the photographs of him with his family, and he talks about his life, you think well, he's landed on his feet, and then you hear about, you know, his anger issues and some of the dark places he's been. And it's horrifying. So yeah, it's a huge issue, and I don't know where it's gonna. I don't know what the outcome would be. I just hope that the game can support these players and hopefully help ex-players and help them through, and obviously support the current generation and the generation that are going to follow.
It's from a bygone age, and it's from 1973. But I remember looking at the Barbarians try against New Zealand, and I thought, this is incredible, when I was a young lad watching this. You can see it on YouTube. And for me, it was all about avoiding and evading the other player when Gareth Edwards scored that try. And look, that was an amateur game. It's a professional game now. It's a lot more physical. But is rugby, and I'm a hurler in the ditch, I didn't play rugby, so look, I might be ignorant in this debate, but Bernard, is rugby not just dancing around the whole issue of the fact that the game is much more riskier because it's now a sport of collision rather than evasion?
It is dancing around it, and it's constantly trying to find ways to stop it become just a collision fest. So, for example, this year, two of the new laws they brought in, the 50-22 rule, which means if you kick the ball in your own half and it bounces into the opposition 20, there's a goal line dropout. So if you get held up over the line, the opposition get a goal line dropout. Those two rules, are law changes, have been brought in to actually try and make the game less collision focused. So to stop people kicking those 50-22s, they'll hold more guys in the backfield, which opens up space in the front line. And likewise, we're all sick of seeing 25 pick and goes, you know, close to the line. Now, if you're held up, it's a big risk and you lose the turnover. So I think they are constantly trying. But on the other side of things, coaches are trying to find ways to win. And unfortunately, the laws had been in favour of playing low risk, highly physical rugby. That is, now the laws are starting to change and coaches will adapt to that. But we're far from perfect, John, and I think it's a constant battle and evolution to try and keep the game entertaining, but more importantly, safe.
Won't be the last story.
No, it won't. One thing that's admirable, though, about rugby is that they are doing something about it, and they do have protocols in place to deal with players. And I know it's been more of an issue in rugby, but you do see sometimes in soccer there's a failure of medical personnel to properly go on and grab somebody when they should. You know, you see sometimes that players might have collisions of heads, and there could be players who are down, and you kind of think in rugby they would probably be taken off immediately for an assessment and to see where they're at. But I don't think football quite has those protocols up to speed in the same way that rugby does. So while it is worrying, and as Bernard says, you know, it's something that you see a lot more in the game now, and you kind of hope that there's not just an acceptable level of risk that people are dealing with when they go out there. This is just something that they have to take into account, that the game does seem to have opened up of late. And you can see there was last weekend there was an All Black try where it looked like they were playing basketball. They were just throwing the ball to each other, and it was termed no ruck rugby. So it was just, they were just running in tries, and certainly it's a more entertaining form of rugby, and there's a lot less collisions. So if that's the way the rules are sending it, then I think it's a good way to go.
Yeah, it was Benjamin Pavard, wasn't it, at the Euros? There was that concussion incident with him. But yeah, it's got plenty of legs and it's going to run and run. I suppose, Bernard, there was a time when the game turned professional at the outset, when there was a lax regulation, I suppose, and that's where a lot of these issues are coming out of.
Yeah, there used to be a 2-week mandatory step down period. So I remember playing all our league games for Clontarfin. If I got a concussion, or if one of my teammates got a concussion, and the doctor was notified about that, was it, you didn't play for 2 weeks, and then they brought in the return to play protocols, which meant you could get back in the following week if you passed a series of tests. But for me, the biggest change that I felt was the concussion bin. You know, so being able to get off the field, or for a medics to get you off the field, to get you into the dressing room, into a medical room, and run a series of tests on you to clarify whether you could go back on or not. I always felt on the field, and obviously naively so, that I was crucial to the game and to the team winning. So you didn't want to give up that spot. So on the pitch, you know, you were very slow to actually admit to that. Whereas once you got off the pitch and you realised the game was going on at the same time, and the doctor or the medics were testing you, etc., effectively, I've always felt it was a safer decision being made there. So I thought that was a huge turnaround in rugby, and also the education in terms of you know, how foolish it is to actually mess around with this, and how to, like, not to play on or not to be open and transparent about it. So I do think the game has moved on, but guys are getting bigger, stronger. You know, when you're 16, 17 now, they're streamlining the athletes. The really powerful players are the ones who are getting into academies, etc., because that's what's important. So the natural footballers who aren't good athletes are getting left behind. So the game is still going to become you know, even more physical. So we just need to be very careful around how the laws work, and how we can help players stay safe, but also how we look after them and educate them.
Yeah, I wonder, and I hope I'm wrong, that I wonder rugby going to be facing a big bill in 20 years from these issues, like, coming to home to roost. And I think that they're beginning to. And I just hope that whatever protocols are in place are now mitigating and reducing the risk of these things happening, because it's frightening, it's horrifying. And I do think the human body is more fragile than sometimes people give it credit for.
People are, you see what Caelan Doris did last season, the fact that he kind of said, I need to go and get checked out. and he wanted to take time, and he was happy to do that. That, I mean, that's a good thing. And that, I think Alan Quinlan was in here with yourselves talking about how it's good to see people doing that, and that'll inspire people to do the same thing. And it's more about the person realizing that they need to, this is something they need to attend to. And as Bernard said, not to hide it. There's been stories from all sports, you know, you used to hear it in racing, that after a jockey would take a fall, that their colleagues in the weighing room would be kind of reminding them what day it was, what race course they were at, and, you know, for the inevitable questions that would come to check if they were concussed, so that they could go back out and ride again. It's like the stories of rugby, of if you get hit, you fall down, but you get back up again and you keep going. So people are definitely more cognizant of it now. And I think the likes of Caelan Doris doing what he did will help with people realising that this is something people need to take a lot more seriously.
Interesting story as well in the Sunday Times, Bernard, about David Nusafour. Peter O'Reilly writes that he's the RFU is giving his performance director David Nusafour an 18-month contract extension, prolonging his role as the most influential person in Irish rugby until November 2023. An official announcement is expected soon. So if he's in until November 2023, that'll be after the World Cup. And I suppose if he's the most powerful or influential person, according to the article, I suppose he is, if there's a CEO, Philip Brown is leaving. If he's effectively the performance director, we got to be reaching a World Cup semi-final, don't we?
Yeah, you would think so. It's a bit left field, to be honest. I think a lot of people assumed that David Nusafour wasn't staying on. There was certainly a press conference, I think, last January, where he said he wasn't sure if he wanted to stay on. So it's been something people haven't been talking about. So it's a bit of a scoop for Peter O'Reilly that they're going to recontract in 2023. Peter says, you know, some of this is driven by the fact that obviously the RFU might be looking for, or are looking for, a new CEO at the same time. So to lose two big decision makers at the same time could be a little bit foolish. But he also, in fairness, he highlights some of the concerns in terms of our strategic plan. You know, we're hitting very few of the targets, which you would
take. Yeah, your mic is just a little bit loose, Bernard, so we'll come back to it in a moment. But I suppose, look, for me, when it comes to Irish rugby, they've got to be reaching a World Cup semi-final. It's been 34 years of World Cups without reaching a semi-final, and a team that's, what about 10 teams might play this seriously. So if there's accountability from Andy Farrell's accountability is to David Nusafour, David Nusafour's will be to the new CEO, surely. I suppose one of the failures in recent times, as well as the men's team are playing right now, is that the women's team failed to qualify for the World Cup.
Absolutely, and that comes under his brief, we're led to believe. Peter, it's an excellent piece, and very, as Bernard says, a great scoop for him to get the line that he's staying on. But, you know, he points out that Nusafour has also overseen the chronic decline of the Ireland women's 15s. Another report has been commissioned to explain Ireland's embarrassing failure to qualify for the World Cup. It'll go along with the reports into why they haven't made a semi-final. He points out that after the 2019 tournament, that Nusafour to a degree sidestepped the blame for the fact that Ireland didn't get past the quarterfinal stage again, and that blame was laid squarely at Joe Schmidt's door rather than, you know, the performance director taking any of that blame. But it's surely we all have been saying it for how long now, the next step is to get to the semi-final of the World Cup, and you'd think with the performance we saw yesterday it looks a bit more realistic than we would have thought maybe a week ago. But is that down to David Nusafour?
Yeah, well, maybe if David Nusafour was here, he might have a different view on the blame game around the World Cup. But yeah, Bernard, look, with all these things, it's all about the World Cup for me. Like the RFU are always in a tricky position, especially with the finances that have been really challenged. That they have to win every game, and they have to get bums on seats, and they will next week for the New Zealand game. But there's a lot of short-termism around the Six Nations and having to perform in that for just the health of the union's finances. But you'd hope now that we're in a positive place with a two-year plan for France.
Yeah, I don't think it's all about the World Cup. I think the World Cup is massively important, but so are winning Six Nations, so are winning European Cups, so are having, you know, a strong and vibrant women's game, so a strong and vibrant club game, referee, coach development. All those things come under the mandate of the RFU. So, and the problem is, if you're just going to judge a performance director on getting to a World Cup semi-final, you know, that's only once every 4 years you sit down and look at the performance. So it's definitely, there's a lot of pressure on. There's a lot of elements of aspects of the game that are maybe worrying. And Ireland yesterday, the national team yesterday were excellent, but they are only they're the shop window. The grassroots, the clubs, etc., the committees, the governance, referees is a big problem in Munster Rugby. Brendan Fanning has a little piece about it today, which looks like it could become very contentious and affect the game, because there's a shortage of referees now and games are being postponed. So there's many, many aspects to governance and for an NGB to look after. And the World Cup, as far as I'm concerned, if you're buying there in European Cups, winning European Cups, buying there in Six Nations, we'll get there. But unfortunately, we haven't been as consistent as we probably deserve to be. And the RFU put huge money into rugby in Ireland. I mean, way more than the Welsh do. And if you compare our international results, and that's your judging on it, Wales have got a lot more bang for the buck. So it's a really interesting one. I mean, I can see the logic in it. But yeah, I'd love to see how it's going to play out over the next 2 years.
We will also be interested to see how it plays out maybe over the next 2 weeks for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, folks. Barney Rene in the Observer: United are in a weird place. This whole process is in danger of becoming a real-time experiment. What if you just didn't sack the manager? What if you allowed the process to carry on past mild underperformance into hard underperformance into humiliation? And then, well, what? Something, it seems, that looks a bit like kind of a zombie ball. Albeit one that seems to have a little way to stagger. Manchester United 0, Manchester City 2 in the derby yesterday. Just going through some of the stats here, folks. Absolutely amazing stats on Man United. What was it, 4 touches in the opposition half? That Manchester City had about 67% possession of the ball. But amazing stats that 21% of Man United's home defeats in the Premier League history have come under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. No clean sheets in their last 14 home games in all competitions. And if it wasn't for David De Gea, maybe yesterday it would have been a lot worse than 2-0. But they look a bit rudderless and listless, and they're like the Marie Celeste for me order. They're just drifting into nowhere. There's a lot of writing, obviously, about it in the papers, including your paper, the Daily Mail, on Sunday, about the pundits.
Yeah, plenty of coverage of that. There's a good panel on how the pundits tore into United, with Roy Keane, Gary Neville and Graeme Souness queuing up. Gary Neville said that they were like a drunk staggering at the end of the night trying to win a fight by the end of the match, which is not good. Roy Keane seems to be completely done with them. He says, the defending for the second goal, look at Shaw and De Gea. I've been cross with these fellas for years. I give up on these players. They are international players. I give up. It's, you know, they're just queuing up to slate them at the moment. But you kind of wonder whether that game against Spurs might have been a bit of a sliding doors moment. That maybe
with Conte?
Yeah, exactly. If United hadn't won that, would they have gone and, you know, made the change? Because at that time it was being touted that Conte was the ideal solution to Man United's problems. But they go and beat Spurs. Spurs make the move, get rid of Nuno, and now they have Conte. So where does that leave United?
Bernard, you have... I don't know whether when you were a young lad, did you have the United bedspread, but I think you've a United affiliation.
Yeah, no, I'm a United fan since Kevin Moran got sent off in the FA Cup final. And then I played in Sale Sharks for 2 years in Manchester, so I got to go to a lot of games over there. And I am a fan, although I've probably become a little bit disillusioned with it. But I'm certainly interested in how this all unfolds. And I think it's really interesting. Like, there's a nice little quote from Rob Draper talking about actually Conte, and he says, talent means trouble was an old showbiz mantra from the West End. And I think it's actually relevant to United because, you know, Roy Keane is saying, I've given up on these players. You know, Gary Neville is saying it. Souness is saying it. Everybody's saying they've given up on these players. But they must be talented players. And there's, you know, Paul Hurst in the Sunday Times, he uses an example of when Solskjaer came in first, you know, they quickly spent 150 million, signed Harry Maguire, Daniel James, and Wan-Bissaka. And he just compares with Saka and said, of the 804 right backs in the database we used, Wan-Bissaka topped the list. And he was identified as being the most capable. But at the same time, that summer, Cancelo was sold 60 million to Man City. And he just compares the two players yesterday. So, like, if that database was correct, and even if he wasn't the top right back of 804. Surely he's a talented player, but when you watch him and a lot of his counterparts yesterday or over the last couple of months, it's just hard to see it. And I think there's deeper rooted problems there. And I was lucky enough that I kind of studied a lot of Sir Alex Ferguson for a thesis I did on high performance. And
you imagine
it's so simple. Yeah, I got access to have a look and see what they're doing. I was at the end of the Ferguson era or whatever. But what struck me was how simple the mantra was. So they had three big rocks that they built their whole philosophy on. One was we never give up, right? So we fight to the end. And the whole Fergie time, you know, they scored 81 goals in Ferguson's period after 90 minutes. So that was an example of that. And he always said, you know, we didn't lose the match, we just ran out of time. I know it sounds cheesy, but the team played to that, they trained to that. The second thing was team first. So the example was, you know, he noticed David Beckham, when David Beckham scored a goal, would run away from his teammates and slide towards the photographers for the best shot. And obviously his PR, his agent told him that's the way to do it. Ferguson said to him, look, you know, that's not how we do things in Man United. When you score a goal, it's about the team. Someone has given you the pass. Someone's put you in the position to score it. And next time Beckham scored a goal, he ran away from his teammates again and Ferguson got rid of him. And the last thing was around, you know, we're brave. You know, we do the positive choice. And I think it was just after Ruud van Nistelrooy signed, he had an opportunity to go forward or play a fast forward. He played it back. And in the video review Monday, he just used that clip to say, look at Ruud, you know, this is United. We're brave. And I don't see, and I did look, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was brought in apparently to bring back, to reconnect with that old school values and the Ferguson era. But, you know, I think when you look at what they spent, what these players can do or have done before they've come to United, what they do when they play for their countries, and you see what we saw yesterday and against Liverpool, you know, just recently, you'd have to question, one, is there any tactical nous, or what is the level of tactical smarts that they're getting? And plus, you know, what are their values? And, you know, are they going to fight to the end? You know, is it team first? Are they brave in how they play? I would say no in all of those cases.
Well, City led the sprints yesterday. Their fullbacks were the best players, Walker and Cancelo. And it was just so easy for them to carve United open. And it's not the first time we've seen it recently under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who just, like, where would he manage? If Ole Gunnar Solskjaer now left Man United, who would give him a job in the Premier League or Europe or the Championship? And I suppose that is not good for him when you're analysing his nous and capabilities as a manager. What was Ferguson like to meet, Bernard?
I only had about 20 minutes with him, but very, very impressive. And yeah, he just has an aura about him. I mean, he was in around the training complex for three days, but yeah, he looked out the window at training sometimes, but he had lieutenants on the field. I mean, the players themselves, like, they trained like they were underdogs. And he, in fairness, he did credit, he said the class of 92, that crop, they were very receptive to basically putting United in a place that in 40, 50 years time they'd still be talked about. And then when guys like Cantona or Ruud van Nistelrooy, whoever came into the environment, Roy Keane or Dennis Irwin, players who didn't come through the academy, they all bought into that vision. So, but look, it's obviously much harder now. Would that work again with the current crop? I mean, you know, Klopp can do it, Guardiola can do it, but they're obviously harder to manage. But you still have to find, a club like United have to find the right manager to get the best out of the team and to be competitive. And at the moment, unfortunately, I don't know. I thought the Spurs game was a turning point, but I just think we're going to get a lot of blips unless things change.
There's not really that much writing of analysis about it, Orla, because I think it's already been done.
Yeah, there's a lot of it being done. I mean, as Bernard said, you wonder whether Solskjaer is up to this job. And also, if he's been put in there to kind of channel the Fergie era and that time and the way things were done, it's not really given him a chance to do things his own way either. And there's, you know, there seems to be still this shadow of Fergie hanging over Old Trafford and hanging over Solskjaer, that that's the way things should be done. And, you know, you kind of wonder, would it be better off if they just removed that entirely and said, OK, things are different, we need to move on and let's make changes. You know, I read pieces last week talking about how Liverpool tried for years to do that, and eventually they decided, no, we break away, we move on. And, you know, Jurgen Klopp took it in a different direction instead of trying to, you know, hark back to the old boot room days. So maybe United may need to make that clean break and decide, well, this is a new era. It's, you know, as Bernard said, a new style of player, and maybe we just need to go in a different direction.
Well, one of the, I suppose, issues that's kind of in the papers today is Ed Woodward is leaving in a few weeks, and I don't know if he wants to make the decision to jettison Solskjaer yet, and therefore you could have a drift now until the end of the year. But the danger for the Glazers is, will they get in the top four? It's not about winning the title now or challenging for the title. It's about getting into the top four, and at the moment it's not great. But Brian Carroll will be on the FM from 1:30 to analyse Manchester United's troubles after that derby defeat yesterday. Just actually looking at like team spirit and that in your paper, Kenny already looking to the future. This is Ireland-Portugal on Thursday. Mark Gallagher, this is Stephen Kenny quoted. We look at Italy, at the European champions, and I see them as the ultimate team of self-sacrifice, says Kenny. Every player sacrifices himself for the team, regardless of whether they've been selected or not. When they come on, he gives all to his teammate and his team. To me, they epitomise that. We have to have that culture in the team and in the squad. And also a good piece which Chidoze Ogbenye in the Sunday Times. This is interesting because there's obviously debate now with Rude Doctor leaving the FAI at the end of the year about underage structures, the new director of football, what the philosophy will be within the FAI about development of players, whether they should be exclusive to other sports, soccer alone rather than other sports. And this is Ogbenye quoted in an interview with Paul Rowan. He says he found the GA experience with the school Collège de Cristerie and his club Nemo Rangers particularly enriching, but eventually it was time to move on. I took a lot of pride in beating your local rivals and trying to win the Munsters and other competitions. I prolonged my stay in the game till I was 18, when a county final replay clashed with playing for the Cork City under-19s. Nemo understand now, and they always reach out to me. They're very happy for me. The friends you make and the society of GA was unbelievable, but football was always something I wanted to pursue. Did you play other sports growing up, Bernard, as well as rugby?
Yeah, I played a lot of Gaelic football in Wicklow, and actually played it. So I had a contract with Connacht when I was 21, and someone sent Warren Gatland the picture from the Wicklow People. I thought I was safe. He was in Galway. I was back home for the summer playing a junior B match, and I got a bit of a bollock and had to give it up. But I know I loved it, and played a bit of soccer in school. But I'd be a massive sports fan, and love horse racing. Yeah, into Formula One again at the moment. But yeah, I love all sports.
Lovely piece with Ronan Griffin, isn't there, in the Sunday Times this Sunday. Orla, this is a gentleman who's hoping to get to the Paralympics as a skier. He suffered blindness from an early age, and one of the best pieces I read today with Dennis Walsh.
Yeah, it was excellent. It was a really enjoyable read. I'm struggling to find it now, but he talks about how he races downhill, and he does all this with 3% vision in one eye. He trains on his own. He races with a guide, and he's looking to get to the Beijing Winter Olympics.
Page 10 there, yeah.
He's looking to get to the Winter Olympics and qualify. And it's a struggle for the winter athletes. They always have to fundraise and find
Brendan
money.
We've Brendan Doyle on here on the show, the bobsleigh, the skeleton, sorry.
Racer, yeah.
Skeleton racer. And he spoke about very candidly and brilliantly about his own issues and the funding and the journey. And it's such an exciting journey for them. And this is a really powerful story.
Yeah, it's a great story. He talks about how he had set up a GoFundMe to get money to train full time, and then pandemic, of course, comes along and ruins all his plans. But his long-term plan was always to make it to the Paralympics. He went to Snow Sports Ireland and Paralympics Ireland, and they were happy to support him whatever way they could, but that they didn't have the resources, and, you know, obviously they're very stretched, that he needed to go and do this. So he found a guide L. Murphy. He says, I can train without a guide, but when I'm racing, I have to have one. The idea is that you want to be as close as possible, but you're not allowed to touch. We've got radios in our helmets to talk to each other, the same kind of radios you'd have for chatting to your passenger on a motorbike. But the person that's guiding you needs to be completely confident in their skiing. I need to trust that they're not going to bail or crash in front of me. And if they do, I'm straight into the back of them. So in a slalom race, they go down the mountain at about 40 kilometres in an hour. But in the speed races, they're moving at about 100 kilometres an hour. And Griffin does all this with one functioning eye, which is 3% vision. It's an amazing story. It's a great read. He talks about how as a child he had retinoblastoma, which was a cancer behind his eyes, and that's what led to his diagnosis.
No, it is it's a great piece. Did you check that one out, Bernard? Or?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And it finished in his life, there's been no limit. And he just, you know, he spent a lot of time in Ronald McDonald House as a kid. And you know, he even, like he said, I didn't have a PlayStation home, but I had one in hospital. Like, he seems to take the positive out of every situation, and he's had an incredibly difficult time. But I'd love to see him get the opportunity to, you know, to chase his dream now. And he just needs to find, there's lots of obstacles in his way, but reading this, you would have no doubt that in a year or two we'd be talking about him having achieved his dreams.
Yeah, Ronan Griffin there, and it's definitely worth checking out, folks. That's in the Sunday Times today. Probably the best article I've seen in the Sunday papers today. This is in the back of the Sunday Independent from Dara Corhor. So this is Laytown win completes special feat for Enright. So Mark Enright has ridden now a winner at every single race course in Ireland. What an achievement for him. Nicknamed Fish, the jockey. So I kind of accept at this stage, I'm not going to be a champion jockey, says the man known to everybody as Fish, since his suggestion to housemates and fellow jockeys that they buy some goldfish. After a stint at St. Patrick's University Hospital and armed with antidepressants, counselling and tools he picked up to recognise warning signs and deal with them, he returned to the saddle. He was very open about his mental health struggles. When I came out with my story, I was petrified people would be tiptoeing around me. The day I came back riding, I rode in the Hiestas Chase in Goran for Michael Horgan. I was going to the second and I fell off at the last. I was going to be second at the time. All that was going through my head was that no one would be given out to me, they'd be too nice to me, and I'll never forget it. Harrigan appeared out of the fog. 40 effing thousand pounds for a second and you fell off, you stupid bee. I was never so happy to get a bollocking in all my life. I know, and no one now thinks any different of me. I'm making a living out of it. I'm enjoying it. You see the good bits. There are a lot more bad days than good days. You've got to go with the flow. There's a lot of lads riding a winner on the beach. Mightn't be anything much under the circumstances. I got a great kick out of it. So did we, says Derek Orr with Mark Enright. And that's a lovely story, isn't it, Orla?
That's a really good read, yeah. It was nice for him to get the set. There's not too many jockeys have done it. I think Ruby has done it. I'm not too sure how many more have done ridden a winner at every track. But yeah, Mark Enright, like, he'd be very popular within racing. And as you said, he spoke very openly after he suffered some depression issues, and he talked about that, and talks about how helpful his colleague Mark Walsh was to him. Mark Walsh was speaking to him when Mark Enright was suicidal, and Mark got in contact immediately with Adrian McGoldrick, who a lot of the jockeys, all of the jockeys, would speak extremely highly of. He was the former medical officer in the Turf Club, and helped him overcome those issues. He went to St. Patrick's, and he overcame the depression with his medication and whatever. So it's a lovely story just to read how he's come out the other side now, and he's just really enjoying his racing, and life has turned around a lot for him.
It's funny in the piece, Bernard, that the trainer, I don't know if the horse is fancy, but the trainer said that the horse enjoyed being on the beach, and that obviously came to pass at Laytown the other day.
Yeah, but so it wasn't easy for him at all. I mean, he actually didn't have a ride, so it's one of his little goals he set himself, and he knew that Laytown was the last, as he calls, the ball to drop for the last 4 or 5 years. And obviously, as a national jockey, he wouldn't get many opportunities to ride there. So last year, obviously, the fixture fell foul of COVID. And declaration morning, he had no ride. So he got on the phone. He was trying lads, ringing lads. I couldn't get a ride. I thought I'd have to wait another year. And God knows, I might never do it. But his friend is his trainer called Dennis Hogan. He had two in the race. And suddenly a vacancy came up on Hell Left Loose. But didn't really have great form. The form was on soft ground. But when he got into the parade ring, yeah, the owner said to him that he had done a little bit with a five-year-old on the beach at home, and he seemed to love it. And then suddenly he gets a lovely ride through, and yeah, it's just a great story. Like, he's still 29. I mean, he still has loads of time, but you know, he covers the fact that, you know, the help he got for his mental health. I mean, you know, Orla mentioned it there, but you know, he actually he spent 3 days out drinking with colleagues, but he made his mind up he was going to take his own life. And the last visit was to Mark Walsh, the jockey. And he was going to head home then, and then it was going to be resolved his final time. But thankfully, he opened up to Walsh, and from there, he got the help that he needed. And, you know, he just, it's something that's, I think, it's in that sport as well. There's a lot of, it's a very tough sport, and I think jockeys can be vulnerable and can suffer from mental health. So he's been very open, and he's only 29. I mean, to have ridden a winner in every track in Ireland at 29, I think he's been hard on himself in terms of his own quality, and you know, hopefully he can have a lot more milestones before he finishes.
Not the only racing story today, Orla. We also have that ongoing issue that between Bryony Frost and Robbie Dunne, and David Walsh has written about it in the back of the Sunday Times.
Yeah, David Walsh writing about it here, talking about how the Jockeys Union, the PGA, kind of came out during the week saying that they didn't think that it would get a fair hearing for Robbie Dunne, which he's kind of pointing out that they represent Bryony Frost too, so it was a bit of a strange intervention from them. It's a short enough piece from David. There's a very good piece, actually, I'll point people towards. It's online. Lydia Hislop wrote a piece.
Okay. She's a racing journalist.
She's a racing journalist. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'd say if you find her Twitter, you'll find a link to the piece. But she wrote a piece, and it's, if this is a little indecipherable for people who maybe are not that interested in racing, her piece is targeted at a general audience and kind of explains the situation and what's gone on and what the issue is with, you know, the fact that the PGA came out to kind of say that they don't feel that this should go ahead now because of all the information that's been leaked in the media. And she makes some very good points about how much of a struggle it's been for Frost to kind of continue with her day job now in light of everything that's come out.
Is it a case that they don't want it to be out because of the reputational damage for the sport?
You wonder. I mean, she talks about how there was a queue of people kind of coming out after this had all come to light, saying that, you know, that's not my understanding of weigh room culture, and people saying that they had never seen this kind of thing take place. But she points out that, you know, just because it hasn't happened to you doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And
I'm not sure if it would happen here.
I don't know, because it's a much smaller kind of group here. It's a tighter knit kind of. You have a less number of jockeys.
You do get a sense that there's a real close knit feel to the Irish jockeys, and Rachel Blackmore included. That I get the sense there's a good vibe in the Irish weigh room. I might be wrong, but I do get that sense. Whereas maybe it's a harder place in the UK. But this, like, Bryony Frost is one of the leading lights of, like, when you ever think about, like, the ITV coverage of Cheltenham or Kempton when she won the King George and throw it on. She's one of the marketable people they have in racing. So this is something that, you know, needs to be sorted out.
Absolutely. I mean, you don't want to hear of anybody having the, you know, what she's talked about and how hard it's been for her, that she's been so upset and scared and, you know, worried for her own safety as well, you know, that she's been threatened, and she's been, you know, ringing her dad, who is a former jockey, talking about, was I doing something wrong? You know, wondering, was she in the wrong? Was she doing the things that she was being told she was doing, which she didn't feel was the case? And she seems to have really struggled. But as you say, it does seem like it's because there's so many more meetings and jockeys, and it's a bigger group over in the UK. You would like to think that it's a tighter knit kind of community here among the weigh room in the Irish weigh room anyway.
We'll see what happens with that case with Robbie Dunne and Bryony Frost and the outcome of it in the coming weeks. What else was in the papers today? There was an interesting article with Henry Shefflin, kind of a profile of him, not really an interview, but a profile from Barry J. White in the Sunday Business Post, kind of interviewed what I think Liam Sheedy, DJ Carey, spoke to Davy Fitzgerald. Just one thing I took out of it, Bernard, one quote about Brian Cody. Now, maybe this is from the past, from Henry Shefflin, or maybe from his book or whatever, but for Shefflin, that austere Cody era started after the All-Ireland semi-final defeat of 2001 when they were beaten by Galway. He said, a barrier went up that year which essentially told people he wasn't in the job to be their friend, and that barrier never came down. I don't believe it's come down since then, Bernard.
No, look, I'm sure he has shifted his managerial style a little bit, but I'd say he's still got the same core fundamentals that he has used to be successful. And I suppose he just needs to find the people who will be able to do what he needs on the field. And it's going to be really interesting to see how Henry Shefflin, you know, manages Galway. Obviously, as an outsider going in, you know, we know he was an incredible player. He's had success as a manager, but it's just going to be fascinating to watch, particularly when Kilkenny play Galway. But I wouldn't knock Cody for if he is that is his mantra and his
well,
style.
What was it 11 All Irelands?
yeah, and players like the players of that time they performed with that style. So, but that mightn't work. You know, that might be transferable to another county, but it certainly hasn't done Kilkenny over the last long period. And he obviously recently hasn't been as successful, but. It is, yeah. Any insight you get into someone like Cody, who's so successful, I think, you know, it always is interesting.
Tom Parsons, this hasn't gone away, this football proposal B debate and what will happen in February's Congress in the Sunday Times. Michael Foley, I'm quoting here, a number of counties we know, the likes of Antrim, Cavan, Fermanagh, went against the wishes of players that were echoed very strongly. Parsons said, if that happens again, there'll be a real swell of frustration among players. I'd be very surprised if something was brought to the floor that wasn't favoured by players. This would just leak away too much into the frustration in the game. It's imperative that players' development as human beings is not compromised by committing a significant amount of time to the game. He said, I want to make sure when players leave the game, they leave it not frustrated. We need to create a culture of caring for the players. So will the football championship be revamped? Tom Parsons wants it to be. He's the boss of the GPA. And he kind of makes a very kind of good point about this. I thought this is important. Sometimes you need to drop the term GPA for a minute and think it's the 4,000 male and female intercounty players. That's who we are. When you're editing a newspaper, Orla, would you have found that this was a much bigger debate around an issue of Congress, that Congress now became something that into the public eye that it might not have been before?
Yeah, you felt that the players, certainly, and Parsons and the GPA have represented very well their views, and their views were very much for change. And I think people generally accepted that there was a change needed, but they maybe didn't like the change that they were offered. And then I think an issue that was kind of flagged a lot with Congress was that people felt that it wasn't maybe transparent enough, the way things were decided and how the votes happened and who voted for change and who didn't vote for change. And I think Tom Parsons is very fair in saying that, you know, there was frustration, that the players were frustrated that they didn't get the change that a number, you know, the majority of the GPA members were keen on, but that he wants to now go and understand what are the issues, why did it not pass, and let's work with everybody to develop a change that's palatable to everybody, to players, administrators and fans. But I think the players are the important people here, and I think, you know, it's they clearly want change, so it's just about finding the right
mechanism.
Yeah.
Just before
I think Tom Parsons comes across really well out of this. I mean, he's standing up for what he believes in, but yeah, he's very respectful for the process they have to go through. I just think he communicates the right line all the way through, and even speaking about his relationship with the GA president, you know, he said there's a healthy tension, which is probably, you know, where the relationships need to be if you're striving to get better. So I don't know a lot about him, but reading this article, I think from a player's point of view, you know, they're getting good leadership from him.
Just before we go, just to point you folks to articles that we haven't had time to before we run out of time here. There is an article by Paul Kimmage and the late Davy Tweed, the former Irish international, and how he views those who have passed. He died recently. It's definitely worth your attention. Anything you want to point people to, Bernard? Maybe Neil Warnock, I think, is it?
Yeah, Neil Warnock, he's broken a record for games managed, and it's an insight into his personality. He got sacked during the week from Middlesbrough, and he talks about having his wife crying on the phone. That poor lady. I mean, he seems to embrace the slagging, teasing from the home fans and away fans. But you just feel for her. And he was asked at the end, would he go again if a club rang him to keep them up, whatever? And he didn't say no. He just seems to have this. Paul's article was very interesting as well.
Anything you want to touch upon, Orla, before we go?
A couple of interesting bits about Damien Duff, and that's an exciting appointment for the League of Ireland.
Game changer.
Yeah, it's got everybody excited.
Eamon Sweeney and the something independent about it.
Yeah, and there's a few pieces elsewhere, but it's definitely a very interesting one. It's really, you know, it's going to excite people. It's going to attract people to League of Ireland, which I think is becoming a bit cooler than it used to be.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming in, Orla. Appreciate your time.
Great to be here.
And Bernard, thank you, and enjoy the All Blacks.
Thanks, Sean. Bye-bye.
Bernard Jackman there, the former Irish rugby player, and Orla McElroy from the Irish Daily Mail, the editor, and the editor of the Mail on Sunday as well. We've got to leave it there. Thanks for giving your insight on the Sunday paper review. Enjoy the rest of the day. So Off the Ball on your radio is from 1 until 7 on News Talk and on the OTB Sports app. We've got two live and exclusive Premier League commentary games to bring you. First up, Everton against Tottenham, with Bernard O'Toole and Brian Kerr describing that one from Goodison Park. Then off to the London Stadium for West Ham against Liverpool, Joe Malloy and Keith Tracy providing the call. If you missed any of the Sunday paper review, you can check out the podcast on the OTB Sports app or wherever you get your pods, and you can watch it back as well on YouTube on the Off the Ball channel. We're back on your radio from 1 and we'll chat then.